You know, it's really amazing how culture affects us, not only in our families, in our business, and in society in general. And I'm really pleased to have a gentleman by the name of Mark Lewis on the show today. Mark is an amazing guy. He's been extraordinarily successful in his own businesses, in consulting with other businesses, and really helping to develop the appropriate culture within a business. And he's written a book called Give a Damn, The Ticket to Cultural Change. And so we're going to talk about not only from a business perspective, how important culture is, but from a society standpoint, from a family standpoint, how important culture is and how we can literally improve the culture around us so that we can experience a much different kind of experience in our lives and find that happiness and joy that we're looking for. So please join us. I think you're going to find it real good.
At the end of the day, it's not about what you have or even what you've accomplished. It's about what you've done with those accomplishments. It's about who you've lifted up, who you've made better. It's about what you've given back. Denzel Washington. Welcome to Inspire Vision. Our sole purpose is to elevate the lives of others and to inspire you to do the same.
Mark Lewis, how are you doing?
I'm terrific. How are you, Doug?
Hey, I'm doing great. Yeah, I'm really pleased to have you on the show. It's interesting. When I was first looking at things that you've been doing, it kind of struck me because, as you may or may not know, my background is doing some consulting for small businesses, mm-hmm. at least one of the things I was doing. And it always fascinated me how, as I sat down with a very small business owner, not at the level of what you're doing, but with small businesses, and I would tell them, you know, we're going to talk about principles here for your business, but I guarantee you that it's going to move into your personal life. And I really appreciated the fact that with this book that you've written and so forth, that, you know, it applies not only in business, but in personal. But I'd love for you to share with the audience who you are and how on earth did you get to write this book, and talk a little bit about the book. Because, how did you come up with the name, by the way, Give a Damn?
Well, I usually don't like to talk about myself, so I won't try to keep this brief. But, you know, I've been in business. I've been blessed to have great parents who gave me a good education. I worked for IBM for 13 years. I knew that would be a great training ground for me because I always wanted to be an entrepreneur. And back in 1994, I left IBM and started an internet company when a lot of people didn't know what the internet was about. And frankly, I fell into that pretty luckily. And that did really well. We sold that 3 years later. I did some consulting work for a while. Then I merged another business with two other business, entrepreneurial, got bought out by another company. Then I decided I needed to do something different, and I worked for a nonprofit for 10 years because I really wanted to help with the economic development in technology for Louisiana, because it was always considered Louisiana was an oil and gas state or a tourism. And I knew with Louisiana ranking 49th out of 50 states, we only have one way to go up. I mean, that's up, right? So we did that for about 10 years, and we went from 49th to 32nd. I got a lot of help doing it. And then I needed to get back into the entrepreneurial space, and I started doing consulting, worked for a firm. Eventually, we kind of bought that firm out, and then I've been doing consulting work. And getting to the question about your book, look, Doug, if you told me 10 years I was going to write a book, I said, you're absolutely crazy. I don't like to write. I don't read that much. But something hit me that was going on to society probably about 5 years ago that I didn't, that's when the book came out, but it had been going on for about 5 years before that, that I just didn't feel comfortable with. And the bottom line is I wrote the book because I thought the society was becoming more selfish. And as a result, it causes a lot of problems when we become a selfish society, and we need to go back to be a selfless society. And there's a lot of reasons why we need to do that. It makes people happier. I mean, I've got so many things in the book that really brings people to another level.
Right. Well, and so as you talk about it, and originally you were using this mainly in business culture, weren't you, as far as how to improve a culture within a business? Because as I know, it can be a nightmare right from the top down. If you don't have great culture, it's a real problem.
You're absolutely right. And I started really, first of all, doing it on an individual personal basis, because I saw these things going around in society. I just couldn't believe. And that kind of helped transition me to take the book and use it for the development of increasing the cultural aspects of a business, because I have a great saying that a lot of people adopt, and I don't take credit for this, is you hire for culture, you train for skill. And really what drives a company is how good the culture is, how people think of themselves as a family. We're all working together as a team. The kind of a team atmosphere in business society has kind of gone from a teamwork to self-individual. And I know, based on my experiences, culture is what drives, a great culture drives a company to great success. And then you share your success with those people who got you there.
Well, that's right. And you know, what's interesting is I have a few sons, but one of my boys has changed jobs a couple of times. And the reason is because of the culture. And what's interesting, you know, you talk about bringing the group together to create that culture, but doesn't it really start from the top down?
You know, it does. It the leadership in an organization is key. And a lot of CEOs, in my thinking, is, look, I could take out the garbage like a CEO as anybody else. They all have a level of importance in terms of what the company is doing. So I think it's important that you, from the top down, everybody is considered valuable. It doesn't matter whether you're a janitor or whether you're an administrative assistant. They all have some important value that they bring to the company. And that's what's really important. You drive that culture, you reward them for what they do, and then everybody wins.
And what causes a lot of these upper management people to not have that thought and that culture, the whole consideration of culture, where they're more patriarchal and you know, I'm the boss, you're going to do this. What causes that within those management individuals?
I think it's egocentric and ego-driven. They have to prove themselves that they're better than somebody else, and therefore they're in control. I like the idea of having a leader let other people be in control by giving them authority and empowering them to do what they need to do. And even if they fail, it doesn't matter. They're always learning. So you empower people as a leader. And I think people who are in leadership positions that don't do that are suffering because they're so egocentric and ego-driven.
So when you've gone into companies where you just noticed that the culture just was really bad and so forth, what was your approach? And the reason I'm asking about business is because ultimately what we're going to do is we're going to take everything you're doing in business and move it into personal, because I know you have very much of an expertise on that. But from a business standpoint, when you go into a business and the culture just is, it sucks, basically.
Right.
What are some of the steps that you take, and what have you found are some of the areas that at least step by step start to help build that culture into a more positive culture?
Well, one of the key things, and a lot of companies don't do this, is what's my business core values? So what I do, and typically when the culture is really bad, you bring all these people in together and they all agree on what the core values would be of the company. So you sit down and you give, it's a team building exercise. And I have a list of probably 50 core values, and I give a sheet out to everybody and say, okay, I want to know what your top 10 core values are, and you circle them. We bring that all together and we have a discussion, and then the whole team comes up with these core values. That's a driving force, you know, integrity, respect, trust, fun. Those things kind of enter into the situation. And what will happen is this. Those people who don't believe in the core values, those are the people you're going to weed out. And I always say the best way to lose A players is to tolerate C players. So what I'm trying to do is weed out those people. Because if you get rid of a C player when you have these A players, then everybody gets kind of uplit. Oh, I'm so glad it happened. And they're just toxic to the organization. So you have to weed out toxicity among your employees by first starting with what you're core values are of the company, and everybody adheres to them. Over time, that builds trust and it builds camaraderie, it builds teamwork. That's the first step I would take.
Well, and I love that. I smile when you talk about the C players. I remember so many times I've gone in and I would, you know, sit down with the owner and say, look, let's look at your statistics. Let's look at your key indicators. Let's look at each one of the individual key indicators for your employees. And ultimately, if they had five employees, I knew one was a C player. I may have called them something different, but right, they were a C player.
True.
And sure enough, the minute that they were removed from the environment, everything went up.
It's everything, unbelievable how that
everything
works.
Went up. Yep. And it's amazing how you can have those people, you know, in your business, and it really can affect it. And I love what you're talking about core values. And I think that we're going to have a great discussion on that too. So core values, getting rid of the C players. What else did you find really helped in the culture?
Well, what I like to do with an organization is everybody in the organization has to have a goal. Whether you're in accounting, whether you're in sales, whether you're in management, everybody needs to have a goal. And that goal is obviously in what's in the best interest of the company. So when you set goals, then you give them the tools to be able to achieve those goals. Once they achieve those goals, then you reward them for that. And of course, obviously you have team building exercises. The goal setting is one, core values is another one, but having fun, establishing an environment where one day you take half a day out and we're just going to all go bowling. No, we're going to do something that's fun. Let them and reward them for those things. But I think goal setting, something that people have an objective to obtain. If they obtain that objective, they get rewarded for it. Everybody wins. And of course, the leader needs to provide those tools and the incentive and motivation to achieve those goals.
What about communication? What have you found relative to communication?
Well, communication is important, you know, and having full transparency. Now, some CEOs don't like to provide figures and how the company's doing in terms of profit. And I understand that. But if you can say our goal as a company is to achieve revenue X, and not necessarily tell them about the profits, but if we achieve revenue X, then we're all going to take a cruise. We're all going to go on a cruise, a company cruise, and go that level. Those are the kind of things that inspire and motivate people. And everybody helps, wants to help and provide that teamwork to meet those goals. So there's just so many things that you can do as a leader and really give them, I always say, and when I'm a leader, I give everybody credit. And if it doesn't work, I'll take the blame.
All right. So do you use any kind of, for hiring, do you use any kind of testing to weed out some of those potentially C players before they ever even get hired?
So absolutely. I have, Doug, a very unique interview technique that I developed personally that I actually provide to my I moderate CEO roundtables. My interview tech is totally different than anything you've ever heard of or come up with. And the base on this interview technique is, Doug, I'm going to interview. Here's my interview. I'm going to say one or two lines, and I just want you to tell me the first thing that comes to your mind. There is no right answers. Just whatever comes to your mind. So I have like 90 of these. I'll give you a couple. Favorite car, favorite number, favorite actor. On a scale of 1 to 10, how organized are you? On a scale of 1 to 10, how risk-seeking are you? Favorite sport, favorite color. Now, the whole purpose on all this is to understand how a person thinks and how they fit into the culture of the organization. Because if someone says my favorite movie is Aladdin, or someone says Ten Commandments, I mean, there's a difference in how those people think and their mindset. If someone says a Maserati or a Camry, there's a difference. If someone says red, color red versus color blue, blue's a soft color, red's a hard color. All these things gather together and give you an impression of how this person thinks, like morning or night. All these things add up. And it's the most phenomenal revenue interview technique, and it's proven to be very, very successful. Again, hire for culture, train for skill.
So what are you going to do if my favorite colors are blue and red?
Well, you can't have two favorite colors, right? You can have one over the other. Now, it's probably purple, right? Something like this.
Actually, it is blue and red, but it goes back and forth depending on the day.
Well, absolutely. But it just, you know, Doug, it tells people something about them that you would never get in a normal interview when you ask questions. Tell me about your past, you know, that kind of stuff.
Okay. Let's take it from business now and let's go into life. Okay. And a personal life. Okay. So you've been talking a lot about a bunch of things. So let's talk about what on earth is going on right now in our society, based on your viewpoint, relative to all of these protests and, you know, where people are going and burning stores and robbing and stealing and doing all of those types of things. What's going on? Because we're talking about a culture that is just horrendous right now here in the United States.
It certainly has gotten out of control. And the reason being is because people are now thinking internally, more so internally than ever before. When you start thinking internally, you don't really think about what your actions are having on other people. So let's say, for instance, you have all these people going out and they're robbing stores. If you knew the person, and again, this gets internally, let's say it was a store that your father owned, would you go in and rob that? No, because now you can internally think that it's something that means something to me, and therefore I do something about it. But if it doesn't have any connection externally, then you don't care. You say, oh, okay, this is okay to do. But if you can internalize something that would affect you, then you do something about it. In order, you give a damn. You don't go rob your father's store, or you don't go burning a building. That's the fallacy that people have. They fail to look and think externally. Is it the right thing to do? Would you do this to someone you're very close to? We've gotten away from that thinking, you know, and of course, all the social media stuff has had a huge effect on it, and it builds and builds and builds, but you wouldn't do these kind of things to somebody that meant something to you. I have an example in my book real quick. A man was walking out of a store. He had some milk in it. It was an old man. He got hit by a car. He flipped over. The car after car didn't help him out. I'm sitting there looking at this video, go, why are you helping this guy? He's hurt. Car after car went around him until someone finally got off for about a minute and a half. Now, let me ask this question. If you were driving your car and that old man was your dad, what would you do? You would get out immediately to help that person, because now you can internalize something that would affect you. And that's where our society has gone wrong. We have to start thinking about other people and what we can do to help them be a better person or be a better, and it all comes to being a better society. I think that's the internal mechanism that's caused our society to go downhill.
Okay, so let's ask the question, what's caused that? Because we've seen that decline beginning time over time, and to the point now where if you were talking to some of these people with what you just said, they may flash you the bird, they may just walk away, you know, whatever. What is the root cause here, and how do we go about getting to the point where we can change that thought process, that those habits, the neurological pathways that are causing these people to do these things and to think this way? Now, you mentioned social media, and I think that's an important one. We talk a little bit more about that. But what else has caused this over time? Because I think, I don't know, maybe you have a different point of view, but I would think that if we understand the cause, we can begin to figure out the solution.
Well, there are multiple causes, and I think one of the main causes is technology. When you think about where we were, when you and I were growing up, we're both seniors, obviously. When we were growing out, we participated in playing games outside. We'd kick the can. We had interaction with other people, played softball. We did all the kind of things that kids are supposed to do outside. Today, the technology is now you stay inside and you play these video games that shoot them up and kill them. And I think that's a problem. We don't have that human interaction that we had 20 years ago, face-to-face connectivity has gone by the wayside with social media. We get lost with this nonverbal communication and these emojis. So technology's played a role in that. I think government has played a significant role in this. And the fact that now government has encouraged more of an entitlement society and not a consequence. So if I do something wrong, then I almost get off. There's always excuses for somebody to do that. They do something wrong. There's something in the past. We can't continue going down the road and let people off for making a mistake. When you make a mistake, you pay the consequence for it. You don't get off. I think there's a wealth factor involved in that. I think religion has been more taboo than ever before. So people don't have this mentor or God. And if you don't believe in God, you have a mentor that you can connect with that can help you do all the right things. So, you know, there was a study also in the book that I have in the book, and Ohio State did a study on religion, and they found out that people who are more religious actually live 4 years longer than people are not. Now, why is that the case? Because there's a certain comfort level knowing that God's there, or it's a mentor. If you don't believe in God, there's a mentor there that can help support you. And stress is a huge factor on the body. The more you can reduce stress, the less effect it's going to have on the human body. So there's a multiple factors. I actually have 9 of them in the book that have caused it.
Interesting. And you know, you talk about religion, and obviously there are those now that have kind of moved away from religion. They still have that faith in the higher power or in the universe or whatever it is. But that's fascinating that you're talking about the fact that people live longer and quite frankly, are kinder.
You know, kindness is huge. There is another study that's in the book that talks about how people volunteer. They support. They may be going to a health center, or they may be going to a assisted living center to help people. They have found that people, when you volunteer and you help and you do these good things to help other people, it makes you feel good. So there's 2 things that happen here. You feel good because you're really helping somebody, and they feel good. And what does that mean? It means you live longer. When you volunteer, you live longer doing all the good things. Now, why? Because it reduces the stress on the human body. And that's what's causing a lot of illness, stress. It's a factor that everybody agrees with. The more stress you have, the more ailments you have, you don't live as long, you're not angry, all these things kind of add up. And what I love about the fact about all my research in this book is that when you do these things, which aren't hard to do, everybody wants to live longer, right? You would think you live longer, you have a better life. It's a no-brainer.
and you know, you talk about mindset and the fact that today's society, the mindset has really deteriorated. You know, I've studied this a lot. And in fact, I'm, you know, thinking and trying to write a book, which
it's hard.
It's tough.
Yeah.
But what's interesting about that is that when someone has developed a mindset, you know, and if it's social media, if it's these games, whatever is doing it, and if it's society in general, once that mindset has been put in place, that is a tough one to change. It literally is a habit. Yep. And it's a neurological pathway that has become a habit. And yes, we can change those. But how do we go about, I mean, here you are, you're doing what you're doing to try to change it. I'm doing what I'm doing with my show to try to make a difference. How on earth do we get into this society? I mean, it's throughout the world, but let's just worry about our society here in the United States. How does one go about changing that mindset and improving that mindset to kindness and to unselfishness and those things?
Yeah. 2 thoughts come to mind on this, Doug. One is changing mindset is very difficult, but we need more of you to go out there and get that message. We need the media, which is a huge factor, because all they ever think about and talk about are things that are negative. That negative mindset transitions to people. How do we get people from a negative mindset to a positive mindset? That is very, very difficult and almost impossible. So how do we fix this? How do we get people? Well, we need to create more of awareness. But I think the key in all this is that we have to educate our younger kids, starting with kindergarten, on what it means to have morals, education, yes, sir, please, thank you. And my wife's a teacher. And I said, we're not educating these. Oh, we do it all the time. I said, well, guess what? It's not getting through. If we educate these people and have a course like moral education, kindergarten, never have it like it's like in English or in math. We got to keep continuing to get these kids to learn about moral education and doing the right thing, opening the door for people, everything you can do, kindness, caring, altruistic type thinking. We got to start at a very early age because it's very difficult, like you said, to change a habit. It's very, very difficult. And you know what I do, Doug, is I have this thing right here. It's called Give a Damn. It's a bracelet, right? And so I have to be constantly reminded, and I wear this to make sure that I'm doing the right thing. And doing the right thing is sometimes very difficult because you get caught up in stuff. But I always say, I'm going to do the right thing despite the consequences, because it's very important.
Well, and I think you've hit something really key on the head. And that is, I'm not sure how much we can change the mindset of adults,
right,
to some degree. And so we're really looking at a long-term type of situation here. When you talk about goals, here is a long-term goal, is can we bring up a generation that is taught kindness, that's taught inclusion, which right now they're being taught just the opposite, I'm afraid.
Right. Yep.
But, you know, being taught all of those types of things, you call it morality. And, you know, obviously that expands into all sorts of different meanings.
Sure.
When we talk about that, how do we do that? How do we get our teachers to start doing that? And ideally, how do we get our parents to start doing that? Because we're dealing with people of different mindsets. I mean, you see the argument going on right now with education and what they're trying to get in and what they're trying to not get in. And parents are now terrorists if they want to control what their kids are being taught, type of thing. How do we go about helping that to the point where we're bringing that generation of children up to a point where we actually have a generation of children who are adults, who are kind, who are loving, who are considerate, who really care about the other people?
Well, that's a tough one. I think it starts at the very top, the education coming down from government and making mandating that we have courses every year that's taught at kindergarten all the way. You know, it's funny because you mentioned this. I have three additional books I want to write. It's called Give a Darn 1, 2, and 3. Darn 1 would be teaching kids kindergarten through fourth grade pictures, opening door, excuse me, all this really simple things I need to do. And then Darn 2 is 5 to 9th grade or 8th grade. And you graduate up and then you do Darn 3, Give a Darn 3 to high school students. Why can't we have something like this that teaches them every year about education on a character, what they call character education, and how important that is? We don't have it as a standard course. I want it as a standard course. So how do I get government to pay for it? I frankly don't know.
Well, and you talk about character development. I think that is the key. Yep. How much of this we're talking about, the education, the government, and so forth, how much of this is the responsibility of the family?
Well, it begins with the parents, obviously. And because of the situation in today's world of, you know, parents, a lot of parents getting divorces, the parents not being at home because they got to work two jobs, being able to provide provide to help with the homework. You don't see that as much as we did 30 or 40 years ago, to be honest with you. My mom was at home and she helped me whenever I needed it, but she provided that stability. But now the kids are much more freer to reign as they please. And I don't know if parents are providing and giving, if a kid does something wrong, they kind of let them off the hook. There's no consequences for what they do. And I think when I was growing up, boy, I paid the consequences for some of the stuff. I turned out okay, I think. But I think it just become too of a lax society bringing up kids to let them get away with what they're getting away with.
Well, and you talk about consequences. It's interesting. As you talk about consequences, there are times that those consequences don't really show up for quite a while. And therefore the attention on that is not as strong as it probably should be. But as we look at this, you've mentioned a few, but let's talk about what are some of the key principles that we really can teach our children in a way that will start to move that generation in a direction that's going to bring about a greater sense of peace, a higher level of culture within the society.
So I think the first thing that comes to mind is most people know what's right, but they do the wrong thing because they can justify it in their mind as being right. Now think about that. People do the wrong thing because they can justify it in their mind as being right. I think everybody knows what's right. Like, for instance, let's say I'm outside, I got a wad of paper and I throw it in the garbage and I miss it. Oh, someone else will pick that up. That's okay. Well, that's not the right thing to do. It's such a minor thing. You should go back and put it in the garbage, not rely on somebody else to pick up. That's a very simple case. But you have to start thinking. And what we do is we forget to think about what's right and what's wrong. Think. You have to be constantly reminded, I'm going to do the right thing despite the consequences if I do the wrong thing. I'm going to suffer them. And I think we just have it in our mind that we got to continue always to do the right thing. And if you do that, your life's going to get better. You're going to feel better. You're going to make other lives feel better, and everybody wins. I think that's just a key component, is to think about what I'm doing and whether it's the right thing. Again, we just don't do that. We just go about our thing and just, oh, that doesn't make any difference. I don't care. That's the wrong attitude to take.
Do you think we're ever going to be able to get to the point where we've got our kids out playing again and they're not spending so much time? I know I've got a couple of granddaughters that are playing soccer, and they just, yeah, they're out there playing soccer. Other grandchildren I have, they love to play games. In fact, I just keep getting messages, let's play a game. And it's like, I have no clue how to play a game like that. Yeah. But how do we move them? Because I would imagine just that interaction between children where they're learning to get along, if they're not getting along, we're helping them to do that. How do we encourage the families to get their kids outside, other than the 19 degree weather I'm in right now? But how do we, how do we get them to get outside and start to socialize and start to mingle again with their peers?
I think it starts with the parents, obviously, and the parents need to realize that when the kids are doing activities like playing soccer, playing basketball, or playing with their peers, that there's obviously less chance for them to get in trouble and get in with the wrong people. Because a lot of people who don't do anything have a way of trying to find out ways to do something that's probably not the right thing to do. So encouraging children to get involved in sports and games such as chess or checkers, or spend the time doing things with other people. And I think it comes down to, it's as simple as, okay, you're as a parent, you're going to need, you give a child a goal. Okay, we want you to play a sport. What sport do you want to play? We want to get better at. How do we practice that? Or give them, okay, you got to play 3 hours. You get limited time watching TV, or you get limited time playing games on a computer, those kind of things. So there has to be rules and direction and structure for kids. And not give them a free rein. The structure, and it works in business too. When you give them rhythm and structure, then they perform better. And I think that's what we have to do now at the family level, and kind of take what we do at the business level and bring it down to the family level.
Talking family level culture. And as you know, with this pandemic, the divorce rates have gone out the roof. And I think part of it, as I look at that, part of it is just my guess is that all of a sudden people are having, they don't have an excuse to get away from each other. They now have to deal with the fact that, hey, here's who I'm with. What are some of the factors that you find within a family that can actually really improve that culture? I know that, one thing you talk about business, and I think, again, it goes, what are their core values?
Right.
And what's interesting is sometimes the core values of the kids is not necessarily the core values of the adults.
You know, it's again, it's getting together and feeling that the family is a close adhesive unit, like the family of a business that is working together through goal setting or core values, doing the right thing, and just sitting down and making sure that the family values are agreed upon by everybody and that you're an important part of this family. And we want to make sure that you succeed and we'll do everything you can to succeed. And, you know, and I used to get accused for trying, and God bless my kids, trying to bring some of the business stuff to the family atmosphere, but I don't think it's enough. But my kids turned out great and, you know, they're doing great. And it was tough love. You know, we got to exemplify tough love. And that tough love is making sure that, you know, they're successful, giving them the opportunity to be successful, giving them the structure, giving them the actions that can help them develop as a human being, and all those kind of things get together, and not just letting them go. Structure within a family atmosphere is just as important as structure in a business atmosphere.
So let me ask you this question. How important do you think it is, number one, to understand the personality of your children and each other to the point where you really understand how do they choose to be communicated with? As you know, you have some people that are very, you know, they're red. You have some that are blue. You have the reds talking to the blues. The blues are going to cry. And, you know, and if the blues going on and on and on about this wonderful thing, the reds are going to just go, you know what, will you just get to the point type of thing. So how do you help these families, number one, to learn, to recognize and to learn how each other really, their personalities, how they want to be communicated with, how they communicate. Again, what are their values? What are their individual goals as well as their personal goals or the family goals? Because so oftentimes I've seen where, quote, parental goals, parental culture, parental, this is how it needs to be, gets so jammed into these kids that ultimately it creates some real issues of guilt, shame, and frustration and anger.
Well, you know, like I know that everybody has a different a personality and all our kids have very different personalities, but that's true in business too. So you understand as a parent what motivates them. But I think transparency is really key in the family atmosphere. It's like, parents typically don't like to admit when they make a mistake. If they make a mistake, they need to admit it. There's a trust and respect that's there that the parent has to have for the child and the child has to have for the parent. I used to get accused. I'm divorced. I'm remarried. But I used to get accused of being too much of a friend to my kids. But I wanted them to understand that even though I'm the parent, I also want to treat them as somebody who I can be friends with, and therefore they can open up to me. So if you become a dictator, then nobody's going to want to open up to you because you're not a good person that anybody wants to talk to. So having that relationship where the child can come to you and you can go to the child and say, look, I'm sorry, I did this. I was completely my fault. And they can come to you and do the same thing. That trust and respect as a parent-child relationship is huge. And you build that very early through transparency, through admitting when you make mistakes, open communications. And even though the personalities are different, you know, that can be part of the family atmosphere and explaining. It's like, Joey here, he's got a different personality than you. And just talking about it is key.
Well, and it's interesting. I have a very special interest in that. I had a couple of boys that did not get along in high school. They were just very different. And I actually put them through a personality program course type of thing. It made all the difference in the world. They have become best friends. And even today, they know how to talk, how to communicate. But I think you hit a really key thing, this transparency aspect of communication, being willing to admit, being willing to really be transparent. Hey, when you did that, here's the emotion that just came up in me. And, you know, and I can't figure out why I'm getting triggered that way, but I want you to know it's not your fault. It's my emotion. But then you have to get into this fact that how can you listen to these things that sometimes might be a little bit tough to listen to and be forgiving and non-judgmental?
You know, you hit on a really key point. And the key point is not being judgmental, but talking about how you feel and how that made you. Because a lot of times we talk to our kids or even talk to some of our employees and make them and accuse them for doing something and say, well, look, when you did this, this is how I felt. It hurt the whatever. So you talk about how you feel and not saying, well, I can't believe you did this. And then it becomes very defensive, accusational. You don't want to do that. Talking about your feelings and how it affects you is non-judgmental. You're just talking about what you feel, and it's a lot more easily acceptable than doing it the other way.
Well, and I think you're right on that. As I've worked a little bit with couples and so forth, it's like, are you willing to be transparent? Are you willing to say, hey, you just did this, and rather than me getting angry at you doing that, I want you to know that this brought up this emotion in me. I brought up this emotion because every event has no emotion attached to it. We only attach the emotions that we personally, based on our perception, are going to attach to that. And I think that taking responsibility for that rather than, as you say, blaming someone else makes a huge difference.
No doubt. I have a favorite word that I use, and it's very difficult for people to understand. It's very hard for people to make, or it's easy for people to make assumptions about a particular thing and whatever might happen. When you start making assumptions, you don't know for a fact. It's called assumicide. All right, because these assumptions can really backfire on you. And I call it a suicide. You have to verify. So these assumptions, whether they're true or false, you can't do it. Most of the time they're false, right? So it causes a lot more strife by making and adhering to assumptions when you really don't know. So never think and try to make assumptions until you can verify the facts. And that's really important. A suicide is a great word because you don't want to go there.
Love it, love it, love it. So I know you've got some great stories, probably with your book and so forth. Any stories you can share with the listeners as far as how some of these principles have made a difference in someone's life?
That's a good question. I think the first thing that came to mind was back in 1994, when I was with IBM, I had a great career and all that. And I left IBM to become an entrepreneur. And I went to work for this company who was an engineer. He didn't know nothing about marketing sales. I went to work for free. He put me on the board of directors, and it just didn't work out. So 3 months later, he wants me to go to demo this product. I go to Toronto, it doesn't work. I come back, he accuses me of not knowing what I'm doing. The engineer says it was a fault product. Then he wants me to go to Maine to demo the product. I said, I can't do this anymore. So I resigned and I had no job, no nothing. But you have to understand, you create your own luck. You create your own initiatives. And at that time, 2 weeks prior to someone introduced this thing called the internet, 1994, nobody really knew what it was. He had Prodigy, but we wanted to provide internet. So I put together a business plan and I worked out a charge equipment on my car. The next thing you know, I was providing internet connectivity for businesses. I think what happens is everybody has challenges in life. And you're going to go up and down. But you as an individual has to go through these challenges and say, I know who I am. I'm capable of doing this. I know how it's going to work. I can make this change and I can make it work. Look, 10 years ago, I'm a much different person than I am. Here I'm 64 years old. When I was 55, I was much different. I've learned so much. And that's the reason why I wrote the book. Sometimes you get lucky. You create your own luck, but really it takes time to make change. Anybody here can go through it and have change in their life for the better, not only for you, but for everybody else. I'm fortunate that I've been able to get to where I am today. And I want to make a difference in other people's lives by writing the book and doing this, these cultural changes in business to improve society. One person can't do it alone. We have to get everybody to kind of work together. And I'm trying to create what we call a give a damn movement where everybody would take this pledge. If you go to giveadamnbook.com, you can take what I call the accountability pledge. It says, I pledge to do all these kind of things, and you can go through it. I want to go through it too, too quickly, but those are the things I would say to people. Look, I'm trying to help better your life. You can do it yourself, and I'm willing to help you do that.
Yeah. And you had mentioned in somewhere I picked up that you had a story about a mom and a son and that they had read your book. Yeah. What happened there real quick?
Well, there was a millennial and he wanted to buy a copy of the book, and then he bought a copy of the book for his mom, and they both read it. And then after they read the book, they were going to come together and talk about it. And he's a friend of mine. I've known him for several years now. This was probably 4 years ago. And he said he sat down and talked to his mom. And one of the comments he met was, he said, look, this really changed my life. My mom and I had a great discussion, and my mom and I are closer than we've ever been before because of what we read in your book. And that to me, Doug, is all that's worth it. If I can change one person's life at a time and create connectivity and create a value system and camaraderie and love by what I've done, I want to continue to do it. God gives me drive and passion to do it for others as well.
Amen. Yep. So Give a Damn, The Ticket to Cultural Change. And again, remind the audience how they can find the book.
So here's a copy of the book. This is you can see it. I got to do it.
Not going to see it. And those that are listening, you're not going to see it anyway.
Oh, okay. you can go to giveadambook.com. You certainly go to amazon.com and look up Give a Damn Book and my name, Mark Lewis. You can order it online, or you can send me an email and I'll send you a personalized signed copy of the book if you order it online. But just contact me at mlewis@giveadambook.com. Let me know what you want, and I'm happy to help you out.
Well, Mark, thanks so much. This has been a great discussion. I really appreciate what you're doing.
Yeah, I want to tell you, Doug, though, I appreciate what you're doing, too. This is really an important part of what we need to do for society, and I can't thank you enough for having me, but more importantly, thank you for what you're doing and helping society get to be better.
You bet. Likewise. And folks, thanks for listening. I know you enjoyed it. And just those baby steps, you know, as I've worked with small business owners, it was always a joke. I said, the first thing you're going to have to watch is this movie, What About Bob? And they're looking at me and going, and some of them have never heard of it, but those that have seen it, they're laughing and going, what do you mean? I go, baby steps.
Yep. Absolutely.
We're going to take baby steps. And folks, baby steps from what you've heard today. Hopefully it'll make a difference in your life and the lives of those that you love and society in general. Mark, once again, thank you. And look forward to chatting with you again soon.
Thank you, Doug. I appreciate it. You're doing terrific.
Thanks. Take care.
You bet.